You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, how the devil are you? This is the Parish Council from the Rocking Vicar, and I'm Magnus Shaw, and if you walk away, walk away, walk away, he will follow because he's Terence Duckham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello, Terence Duckham.
Hello. Now, of course, we're recording this only a few short hours before the biggest moment in English life this year, really.
Oh, really?
The football match against Sweden. It's Friday afternoon as we record this, and you know, and tensions building up, of course.
Oh, I see. I thought you were going to tell me something significant that was happening.
Yeah, two hours time. I just thought I'd actually ask you, Magnus, as a
you're not biting on that football not being important.
No, I passed that by. Yes, I heard it, but I wondered if you could give us a sense of the feeling in Derbyshire at with 2 hours to go. What is the feeling there in Derbyshire?
The feeling in Derbyshire is, well, it's quite icy and damp, actually. There's just been the most enormous hailstorm with a big roll of thunder in the middle. I don't know if that is some kind of prelude to this dynamic event that you're describing or just a coincidence of nature. But Derbyshire is very much preoccupied with a hailstorm that's just finished, actually. How everybody else feels about the football, I couldn't really say.
Can you give us a sense of how Pippa Middleton, what she might be wearing tonight to watch this game?
Is she going? She's going to watch this match, is she?
I'm sure she'll be at home, but I wondered if you had a sense of the.
It's what
reporters say. I was just trying to bring some sort of new dynamic to this, because it's what reporters say to their personnel in the field. They say, can you give us a sense? Can you give us a feeling of how Pippa Middleton feels?
I must point out I'm not in the Ukraine, so I'm hardly your reporter in the field. But
Trust me, it never matters.
No, that's true.
When Anna Botting is throwing out to the reporter outside Parliament, she always asks, give me a sense.
Well, I would say if Pippa Middleton's got any sense, she'll be wearing a bathrobe that she borrowed last time she stayed at Claridge's and some Primark slippers. And if she's really got sense, she won't even be watching the football.
Oh, my God.
She'll be watching Punk Britannia on BBC Four. Oh,
I'm going to have to record that, yeah. I've got a bit of an update for you, Matt.
I like updates.
Last week we were railing against the sheer lunacy of the cost of going to see the Beach Boys at Wembley Arena in September. Yeah. And you may recall we were in much umbrage at the fact that they were £440 each, these tickets.
Yes, we were thinking at least Dick Turpin wore a mask. That's what we were thinking.
Yeah, exactly. I'll give you an update. Just checked this morning, again through the Guardian, your Guardian, the through Seatwave, the price has increased.
Oh, great.
Those two tickets are now £674 each.
You just sort of get to a point. I remember looking up what it would cost me to go to Brighton on the train to watch. There was a 30th anniversary performance of Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds with the original cast at the Brighton Dome, and I thought, yeah, that might make an interesting weekend away. And I looked at the train passes, the train prices, return for two of us, and when I got to £1,400, I thought, you get to a point where you think, well, it might as well be £1,000,000. It wouldn't be any more ridiculous, would it?
It wouldn't be. We live in an absolute insane form of commerce at the moment, where any vendor will stretch the price of anything to the most highest limit on the hope, and often a realised hope, that some mug somewhere will actually pick it off the shelf.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so 600 odd quid now for the Beach Boys.
£674 each.
Oh, right.
Two tickets.
Oh, that's the thick end of £700, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll keep an eye on this and see, see if it goes up even further as the weeks roll by. You've got an update too, I believe.
Well, I have, yeah. I was just just about to say soon it'll only be Brian Wilson who can afford the Well, also raising our ire last week was Mr. Plan B. Ben to his mother, who was promoting his film with a poster that we saw in My Guardian of him sporting a rather large pistol, which we thought was quite inappropriate for a man of his influence and standing with the young folk. Well, as chance would have it, he's managed to copy himself an editorial column in the Radio Times this week, has Mr. Plan B. And he's objecting rather strongly and loudly to being called a chav. We called him many things last week. We don't think we called him a chav. But anyway, he has a reasonably well-argued point about not wishing to be referred to as a chav. However, he does speak about gangster rap, and here's what he says, and I quote, "Unfortunately, some of the words in hip-hop can be negative. Within hip-hop, there's some who romanticize gangster and street life, but there's also a hip-hop with a conscience, and this is what I prefer."
Ah, okay. Well, which then, of course, bears no relation to the fact that he's currently pictured holding an automatic pistol to promote this movie.
Quite so. Quite. He seems to overlook that. Interestingly, he's also attracts some desperately inappropriate sponsor as well, but I forget who it is, Nike or somebody. So his man of the people stance starts to ring a bit hollow, and certainly his affection for positive hip hop is exposed when you see his movie poster where he's holding that big gun. So I just thought I'd let you know that as well as being ill-considered, he's a terrible hypocrite.
For sure. And whilst we're in update mode, another quick update is that regular listeners may recall a few months ago we interviewed the delightful Mary Epworth.
Oh, yeah, we did, yeah.
We did, and we featured a track of hers. Things have moved on marvellously for Mary since then. She's got getting more and more exposure through radio and TV.
Yeah, do you see what happens when you appear on The Rocking Vicar?
This is it. This is where it all comes back to. Yeah.
Your stellar career is assured.
It just takes off from the next minute. If anybody would like to catch up with Mary, she's released her album now, and it's available. You can hear it all for free streaming on the Independent newspaper's website. Okay. The album's called Dream Life, and I just checked it. The easiest way to find it is if you just go to the independent.co.uk, the Independent newspaper's website. Uh-huh. They do have a search box. Stick Mary Epworth in there, and up it comes.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Have you come across that before? I've never known, and I know Prince gave away an album with the Mail on Sunday or the Sunday Express or something, didn't he, a few years ago? But an album being available to listen to on a newspaper's website, you ever come?
It's increasing. Yes, I have. It's increasing. Yeah. It's, the Guardian are usually the ones.
Oh, my God.
Your Guardian are very regular stream hosts for new albums. You're right, but I think it does, if anything, indicate this move that we've talked about before, certainly written about before, that the money, the revenue for artists is no longer in recorded work. They are essentially giving it away. And then, they make the money from touring, merchandising. Yeah. In Mary's case as well, obviously with CDs as well, but also a limited edition vinyl copies of her new album, which is also a collector's edition type thing.
So, can you download it from the indie site, or do you have to be on the indie site to hear it?
You have the website and stream it.
Oh yeah.
It's SoundCloud.
Yeah,
SoundCloud.
Okay, got you.
So
yeah.
It's SoundCloud plays. It's streaming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good for Mary. That's good, and I hope we played had a sliver of influence in her getting to that position when we. Was it 6 months ago that we interviewed?
Must be six months ago.
Well, I hope we shoved her in the right direction because she's going great guns now, obviously. I understand you were rather than slaving away on your piece for this weekend's Rocking Vicar this morning, you took to watching television.
I was. Over breakfast, I, instead of doing what I usually do, which is to watch, I sort of catch up episodes of, The Veep or, you know, Mad Men or whatever. I'd run out of things to watch. So I switched on ITV and I became transfixed by the Jeremy Kyle show.
Oh, Lord.
And, not my regular viewing. And I know it's easy to, take a bit of a stab at Jeremy Kyle, but I absolutely was staggered by this. And I just wanted to mention it in passing because the story that cropped up, I only watched the first segment from, you know, the intro to the first junction, as it were. And it's just the passion of it all just overwhelmed me while I was having my toast and, innocent orange juice. There was this bloke.
Are you suddenly sponsored by a fruit juice brands?
Innocent for all of your
Terence
fruit
Decom
needs.
Peter
was this bloke that came on. He was a young boy. He had no teeth, and he believed he was the father of a child that had already been born. That's important, the already been born bit.
I think you were going to say you believed he was the father of all mankind.
Father of all mankind, yeah. That's only a matter of time before someone turns up on Jeremy Kyle.
I am the father of all mankind.
Yes.
I'd watch that.
Yes, call me Joshua. So Peter with no teeth, he thought he was the father of this child. And then Scott, the new partner of this girl, Kelly, he also isn't the father. He came on with Kelly to support her. Mm-hmm. And there was a bit of a conflagration between Scott and Peter with the no teeth. Because naturally, and one said to the other, "Yeah, what was it you said to me in the job centre?" When they were arguing over about who said what. So, "What was it you said to me in the job centre?" Now, the boy, Peter, the toothless fellow, he bought Kelly a rabbit to try and win her over.
So I find that always works for me. You know, it's like...
It didn't succeed for Peter. It really didn't. Now, I just got to tell you about Kelly. She's 18, just 18. And this is where the confusion came, because we kept talking about this child. And then we spoke about another child. And then she's also heavily pregnant. So she's actually expecting her third child. And this girl is barely 18.
Heavens above.
Which it actually did make me despair. Mm. Peter with the no teeth, he brought on his friend Gemma to give him moral support. So anyway, the whole point of this was that we got DNA results to prove who was the father. And this was revealed live on air on the television.
Oh, they do two or three of these every morning, the DNA.
God. It was both compelling but also soul-destroying at the same time. Mm. I felt so sorry for everybody involved. So Jeremy Carr gets the envelope brought out, as then you'll know if this is a normal process. He opens the envelope, and then rather like on The X Factor when he said, "And the person going home this week is..."
Yes.
It was... "And Peter, you need to know, are you or are you not the father?" And
yeah, there's a pregnant.
"You're not the father." And he actually, Peter with no teeth, turned out not to be the father. And this is where I just felt a really strong sensation here, because he walked off the set in great distress. He said, if you can storm off, he stormed off the set and went backstage. Yeah. And the whole thing was, as I say, this girl with a third child on the way. Excuse me. And I talk about the passion of it all. And the thing that I came out of it with, Magnus, and I don't know whether this is true in all social strata, but such a thin line between love and hate, because at one time these two people were having adult relationships with each other for there to be any sort of concern that he may be the father. Mm. So at some point these two people were as intimate as people could be. And the hatred between them at the end here, where one was accusing one of her, you know, awful mother, terrible house, I'm going to go for custody. Of course, he couldn't when he wasn't the child. But it was just that, you know, at one point, these two must have been an item. They must have been planning what to buy at the supermarket, what to buy at the off license.
Yeah, well, you have to wonder when they were, in flagrante delicto, whether there was much love involved at that stage, to be honest. I think maybe... you're looking at that with some rose-tinted spectacles, perhaps.
I suppose maybe I am. Maybe, I suppose being slightly old-fashioned, I see a relationship that could produce a child as requiring some form of affection between two protagonists, clearly not.
No, not necessarily, no. Just a modicum of cider and boredom, perhaps, yeah.
It was depressing, sure. in the most genuine sense of that word. It affected me, as I drove in to meet some people morning. I was thinking about it, so it was awful. But mainly, as I say, I hope this doesn't sound patronising, I just felt so sorry for everybody involved.
Yeah.
I just felt sorrow for them, because it's just dreadful lives they're having. It's just awful.
But what to everybody, of course, listening, including myself, is absolutely gagging to know is, did they do a DNA test on the rabbit?
Damn, that must have been after the commercial
break.
Yeah,
that would be it, yeah.
I'll have to look it up on the catch-up TV and check it out. Moving on from Jeremy Carr, which I'd like to do as quickly as possible.
wouldn't we all, yes.
Absolutely. Earlier in the week, we watched a programme on our favourite channel for reviewing, Channel 4. This was produced by 2-4 Television, a growing company, actually, when it comes to TV commissions. It's called A Short History of Everything Else, and it's chaired by Griff Rhys-Jones. Two captains, Marcus Brigstocke and Charlie Baker, and the guests this week were Mickey Flanagan, comedian, and Kirsty Walk, who's, for me, her only real purpose of being there seemed to be to give reaction shots. When somebody else says something, they would go to Kirsty Walk and she'd either be grinning or wincing or pulling her face or whatever. The premise of the show, you've got Grumpy Griff in the middle, chairing the thing, a torrent of film clips, and then it follows, you guess which year, and then some Trivial Pursuit questions. A Short History of Everything Else, Magnus.
Yeah, I did see this. When I saw it trailed, it flitted across my mind, this might be the worst thing I've seen on television in a long time. merely from, well, it wasn't even a trailer, it was the continuity announcer trailed it, and I thought, that sounds pretty awful. But of course, that then compels you to at least see if you're right or not. Rob Brydon, maybe 5 years ago, did a spoof panel show, which was intentionally bad, because the premise of what he was doing was to play a version of himself who was on his career uppers and taking anything he could get, which is actually 5 years ago for Rob Brydon couldn't have been more the opposite case. He was actually doing extremely well, but he did this alternative reality of version of himself where he was chairing this absolutely god-awful panel show, which was called Annually Retentive. And lo and behold, the weak concept behind this panel show that Rob Brydon had created was, you got it, they picked a year, they showed some film clips, and asked some Trivial Pursuit questions about it. So, quite astonishingly, Channel 4 have now made this show, which was originally conceived as a parody of a very bad panel show. And, well, you can't fault them on their accuracy, because this was the very living embodiment of a very, very bad panel show. It appeared to me that it had been thrown together in somebody's lunch hour. There was so little thought behind it. It was nothing we haven't seen done much better elsewhere. The concept was as weak on this as it was on the parody that Rob Brydon did. It wasn't funny. It was purposeless. I don't like Griff Rhys-Jones doing this kind of stuff, because he's lost any semblance of humour he once had. He's the same now. He's taken over from Dennis Norden on It'll Be All Right on the Night, and he's appalling on that as well. He was appalling on this. And the final nail in the coffin was that somebody saw fit to drag out a gag about dementia. And people.
Oh, I made a note of that, mate. So I've actually made a little bullet point here. A terrible joke about Mrs. Thatcher's dementia. So inappropriate. It doesn't matter whether it's Mrs. Thatcher or whatever one feels about it, but to make a joke about it in the context it was, I thought it was just grimness personified.
Yeah.
It was the whole program was a nightmare vision of a quiz show. It really was. And I was hoping that, you know, again, we could come up with something positive to say about a TV show we're reviewing. But it was, as you say, it's just a clip show. And we got these clips, clips upon, built upon more TV clips, the Newbury bypass and dragging out film clips of Swampy, the John Lydon of road protesters. This was just a terrible lo-fi version of Have I Got News for You, really. And I noticed this was one of four, a series of four. And if it gets recommissioned beyond the four, then we may as well all give up. Yeah. Because, you know, the world of how these things get commissioned and get put on TV is just a mystery to us all if it gets recommissioned.
No, I couldn't agree more. And it made me wonder what on earth it was doing there in the first place. You know, a channel like Channel 4 must get pitched some half-decent ideas almost on a daily basis. So what gets this through, I can't begin to guess. And the notion that people have been paid to produce this just makes me want to bang my head off the wall.
On the second half of the show, they reflected on the English cricket team winning the Ashes 7 years ago now, and against Australia, of course. And but the focus was not on the fact that the Ashes series was one of the greatest ever, and that would have had some sort of sense of humour, could have been brought in. But they made it all about Freddie Flintoff and Kevin Peterson enjoying a few drinks too many, and there was this sort of boisterous, boyish, woo-hey element to the whole thing, and that led to what I felt was one of the kind of the lowest moments of what was a pretty grim show. It has to be said, it was Griff Rhys-Jones getting a round of applause from a very compliant audience simply for having once advertised Holsten beer. They showed you a clip of him advertising this beer a few years ago when they did sort of some sort of primitive photoshopping thing, sort of Zelig type thing, where they had Marilyn Monroe interacting with Griff Rhys-Jones. And he got this huge round of applause because once he'd advertised beer. One of the problems, one of the problems again with this is we reflected on this last week when we talked about the Jubilee comedians. I looked at the end for the credits. The only writer credited was Griff Rhys-Jones himself. He wrote his own material and it showed.
Yeah.
As I always say to these things, employ some professional, proper writers. You can again imagine the commissioning process. Well, who should we get? Who should we get? I always do a kind of camp voice when I do this. who should we get to host this? Oh, Griff. Griff would be lovely. Griff. And then they go to meet him. Oh, Griff. If you could just write some lovely little ironic links, love. And, of course, that's what he's done. But they're not funny.
No.
That's the thing. Griff Rhys-Jones no longer in his later years. Sorry, Griff. You know, you're now grumpy Griff.
Yeah.
You're not funny anymore.
No.
You do things where you look at buildings that we should preserve and you row boats along the River Thames.
Mm. Mm.
But you're not funny anymore.
No.
You can't write funny. Get somebody in to make it funny.
Well, I mean, this was the lesson that the great comics, you know, where Morecambe and Wise, Ronnie Barker, all knew this, that you can't just sit down and write your own material and expect it to fly. You know, you look at the writing credits on Morecambe and Wise, the two Ronnies and you know, other shows, and they, you know, not only were there a lot of writers, but, you know, they were tried and tested, but the quality control was very high. And indeed, when Ronnie Barker wrote for the two Ronnies, he would submit his material anonymously, by letter and sign it Gerald Wiley.
Exactly. And you're right, Morecambe and Wise, to the best of my knowledge, never wrote a gag themselves at all. They're Eddie Braben and other Joes behind him. Galton and Simpson would be writing for Stepton and Son.
Barry Cryer. Barry Cryer made a living.
Barry Cryer's made a career of it.
Exactly.
I've made much of a career. Most of my adult life has been writing, hopefully reasonably humorous things for other people to deliver.
I have to say that none of it is funny, but at least you made a career from it.
I left a little gap there for you to come in with that, because I just knew, I could hear it coming across, that you just had to say something. You just had to. So we're making short work of a short history of everything else. Channel 4, 2-4 Productions, number one of four's been and gone. You've got three more to go if you want to watch it.
Well, there you are. I think I messaged you at the time and said that it was a waste of electricity, and I think that's where I rest my case, to be honest.
That's pretty much it, sadly, isn't it? It's just, again, you sit there thinking, how did this get commissioned?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And talking of eccentric issues of the week, one of the strangest pieces of news to come out of the week, I you will again recall that when I first was made aware of this, I said, is this a joke? We're talking about two Swedish governmental agencies, the Swedish Institute and Visit Sweden, which is the government tourist agency, coming together to develop a plan to present the country to the world via the medium of Twitter.
Yes.
And to do so, they hired this advertising agency, Volontaire, who decided, and I'll come back to this in a minute because I'm going to ask you your view. I've changed my view as I've followed this through the week. But essentially what they've done is they've handed over the Twitter handle at Sweden to Swedish nationals. And the only control mechanism that they've given to this is the qualifications are, and I quote the advertising agency's creative director, is they have to be interesting, Twitter literate, and happy to post in English.
Yes, yes, yes.
So each week it's handed over lock, stock and barrel to a Swedish resident to say what they like. And that's what they do, Magnus.
Yeah, and I think it's an absolutely fantastic concept for an advertising campaign. It's sort of it's very postmodern, isn't it? It's, you know, it's not something that would have been possible sort of 20 years ago because the platform didn't exist. But I just admire the, I suppose, the courage would be the only word I could think of the organisations involved in doing this. But it was all going quite well. I mean, some of the early tweeters, you get to do it for 7 days if you're a Swedish citizen and you've been handed the key to the Twitter account. And it all went fairly conservatively at first. I think people were posting pictures of, like, this is my street and this is a hill near my street and stuff. Until somebody called Sonja Abrahamsson. When the baton...
Sonja... is a character.
Yes, Sonja is a character. And it was the baton was passed to her. And she really took it to a different place entirely. Her first tweet read like this. Before World War II, Hitler was one of the most beautiful names in the whole wide world. I know. It's... And then she uses the word choking. I think she means choking, perhaps. It's as choking as finding out about dolphin rapists. That was her first tweet on behalf of the nation of Sweden. Now, on the whole, and I know that they purposely attach no rules to this activity, but on the whole, if you're tweeting, particularly if you're tweeting on behalf of somebody else, pretty good idea to avoid A, Nazis, and B, rapists, really.
Yes, that might have been sensible advice to Sonja, yes.
Yeah, then she got all graphic on the project and really started to overreach herself by comping a picture of Freddie Mercury together with a table laden with cakes. That would have been unusual but unproblematic had she not captioned it, "Hungry Gay with AIDS."
Yes, I am actually looking at that now.
Yeah,
yes.
It's followed that up.
Ill-advised.
Well, yes, and followed that up with the fact that she was tweeting from her local shop where she was buying eggs to prevent her from starving like an African child.
Well, I don't know if you noticed, she also, on the food context, she posted a lovely picture of some strawberries that she was having for her lunch.
Yeah.
And she says, "Oh, strawberries, dripping with milk and urine. So tasty."
What I like about this, and I think this it says a lot for the Scandinavians, really, is that I think almost any other country in the world would have immediately changed the password, phoned Sonia and said, yeah, thanks, Sonia. We're just bringing a rapid halt to it at this point, and deleted all the tweets. But what Sweden have done is said, no, this is exactly what we wanted. This is a democracy. This is freedom of speech. And we wanted to show the world how committed we are to giving our citizens the right to speak their minds. And it's all still there, and they're quite happy. Well, I don't know if they're happy, but they're quite prepared to allow these tweets to be part of the project. And I guess that that's a very Swedish reaction. And I guess if they're trying to indicate their national culture to the world, then they've done it by allowing Sonia to carry on her rather surreal mission to tweet on behalf of Sweden.
Yes, she certainly raised awareness, it has to be said, whether the right way. And she's still going. I've just she's still going strong. I've just called up her Twitter account as we speak.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted to say, as I said, I changed my view. When I first saw it, I thought, oh, my God, this is a nightmare. They're going to regret this. Mm. You know, this Sonia is going to wreck the whole idea. But then I saw it as a form of performance art. And I thought of it on the same level as, do you remember a couple of years ago when people used to stand up on that empty column in Trafalgar Square and do what they wanted to do for an hour?
Yeah.
And I rather like things like that. I think it gives us a sense of civilization. And although Sonia has taken this to quite an extreme, I still rather like the idea. The last couple of few minutes, she's been berating a few people. She says that she still remembers the first words. In fact, I should quote her. She says, I still remember the first words I had to memorize in English. Who are you? You live in Sweden. Speak Swedish. Finnish too. And then she says, just kidding. My first words in English were, who the F are you? Except she doesn't say F. No. She says the full word. Yeah. And then she goes and says, I live in Sweden. Speak Swedish, please, and leave. And then, clearly in answer to a number of tweets that must be coming her way, because this is a sort of generic reply to the world, she says, for the last time, I did not learn my English in prison. If I did, I would be much better off. Did you know we have tweeting prisons?
Right. But I agree. I think had many nations undertaken this task, the tweets would have been written by a very carefully selected panel.
Yes.
And then they would have gone to some kind of moderator or indeed PR agency to be tweets and the rough edges knocked off and the party line to be inserted before finally appearing on Twitter. And the whole thing would have come and gone without the world paying the faintest attention to it. But I do think this is terribly Scandinavian. They've sort of metaphorically stripped off everything off, which the Scandinavians are very fond of doing, and let it all hang out. And of course, that's brought it to the attention of the world. So if that was the brief, if the brief was to show that Sweden was more about ABBA and Volvo cars, then the brief has been fulfilled. And I would think that as a campaign, it's highly successful.
My fondness for anything to do with Sweden is going to be measured over what happens over the next few hours. Because we're recording this, it's coming up to 4:30 on Friday. So in a couple of hours' time, our two nations, England and Sweden, will be competing against each other in football. And literally, as we're speaking, Sonia is now telling the world how she feels about Julian Assange and what she's calling his rabies-infected followers.
Giving
value.
Yeah, I can only hope the football coverage the football coverage over in the nation of Sweden is being conducted by Sonia. live and in real time. Yeah, that would persuade even me to watch a football match if Sonia was the commentator. She's taken on this status which is new to human beings in recent years, and of being a web celeb, isn't it? You know, she's here we are talking about over in the UK, and we don't talk about many Swedish citizens over here, and she's achieved that. So for this week...
Oh, she's a shoe-in, surely, for the Jungles, you know, I'm a Celebrity or Swedish Big Brother.
Oh, yeah, that would be a shame, though. Yeah, but I think that would be a shame. I think she should just be allowed to, you know, given her own ongoing platform where she can just pour this stuff out and we can dip in and amuse ourselves every now and again. But
so if you were the advertising agency that had won this brief and been paid a considerable amount of money, you see this as a positive result. Going on about Julian Assange and urine-drenched strawberries.
Well, I mean, the positive result in an advertising campaign all rather depends what the original brief was. And, you know, if the brief had been, we, you know, wish to portray a very fixed and negotiated image of our nation using social media, then, you know, I might be writing my resignation letter as this all rolled out. However, if the brief was...
So you'd have security guards, one each side, as you carried your belongings
indeed,
out in a box.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, yeah. The client lobbing pebbles at me as I was escorted to a taxi.
Or indeed, urine-drenched strawberries.
Yes. Yeah. But if the brief was... we want to use social media to create a buzz across the internet and get people talking about the nuances and idiosyncrasies of the Swedish nation using real Swedish citizens, then I think I could proudly turn around to the client and say, bingo, there you go, delivered. So it rather depends what the original brief was. And I think this is a great success. It reminds me very slightly of a campaign by Visit Australia, their sort of nationalised tourism agency, that they ran not last summer, the summer before, where there was a TV campaign and it said, you know, we've made up a flat for you, we've cleaned the hotel for you, we've set the waterfalls going for you, we've found the kangaroos for you, we've created the beautiful outback for you. And then right at the end, the very pretty girl who'd been doing this just turns the camera and says, so where the bloody hell are you? which I think, and they got a lot of flack for that, and last year's was very, very mundane in comparison, but I thought that captured something about the national character of the Australians. You know, very blunt, very forthright, but still welcoming. You know, and I thought that hit the mark. And I think Sweden have done the same. We always think of the Scandinavians as being as very eccentric and very, what would you say, characterful and left field. And this has demonstrated it for us. We're not going to put anybody off going to Sweden, I don't think. So, I think what we must do is send a link of this podcast to Sonia to,
we must do. Yes. I don't know if she's got her own website, but I'm sure we'll be able to track her down.
We can tweet can't we? Surely we can tweet
it. We can tweet it. Yes. But if you would like to follow Sonia while she's still got control of this, or then to follow on with the handover, Sonia, extremely photogenic tweeter, it has to be said, 27-year-old, holy mother of two, as she puts it.
was that with a W or just the H-O-L-Y?
With the H-O-L-Y,
oh, okay,
yeah. So if you would like to have a look at, if you've managed to catch before it's handed over, you'll get Sonia, if not the next person in the holding the baton. Yeah. It really is quite simple, at just at Sweden, as in the name of the country, and you will find this tweet. 58,000 followers the feed has at the moment, so it's obviously succeeding in what they set out to do, the awareness.
Well, fantastic, and I just think it's a huge credit to the people at the Swedish government and the advertising agency, and indeed to Sonia herself, that it's just been, you know, allowed to happen as it happened, and nobody's tried to stamp any kind of PR authority onto it. I find it very refreshing. It's good stuff.
I would love if we did it here. It would be a sensation. Really would, if we did the same thing over here. And I hope somebody has the good force and thought to do something similar, because I think it would be absolutely marvellous. In fact, you know, it'd be good to see a few different countries around the world do something similar. Absolutely great idea. Yeah. Changed my mind as I learned more about it. I'm going to give a big up, Magnus Scholl. I'm going to give a big up to the pretend iPod, because not last weekend, the weekend before. I meant to mention this last week, but I forgot. I was doing a reasonably long journey back on my own from Warwickshire and run out of podcasts. Didn't fancy much on the radio. There was no sport on when I was coming back. So I thought, I know, I'll listen to the Vicar's imaginary iPod, the pretend iPod.
Oh, yeah.
And I went with to my iPhone and it said, oh, you can't stream it from the site, but it's on Spotify. Yeah, there's a link to it on Spotify. Yeah. So I went, bink, and went to Spotify. And, oh, it was a, in all seriousness, it was a, made my journey back because it was great. It's just a cavalcade of the very cream of music over, you know, the last 30, 40, 50 years, I suppose. Mm. And it was a really great listen. I put it on shuffle.
Yeah.
And it just sounded great. So, despite my cynicism yes, exactly. and sort of thing about, are we still doing this flipping iPod?
Yes.
I really did enjoy listening to the music flowing as I came back down the
M. Skittish young man you are, to be sure. After all
can't
that.
Can't pin me down. You just can't pin my opinions down. I'm here, then I'm there.
Yes, indeed. Yes, yeah.
So, speaking of the imaginary pretend iPod, yep. What have you got for us?
Well, this week I've picked perhaps a band who aren't going to appear in the sort of pantheon of great rock and roll bands of all time. They won't take their place next to Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd or the Beatles or the Stones or the Doors. And the reason I've picked them is perhaps because they are less than iconic. And also because the song I've picked sounds like nothing else I've ever heard before or since. And that's a tough trick to pull off. Mankind has been making music for, maybe 4,000 years. So it's all desperately difficult to create a piece of music that sounds extraordinarily different from everything that's gone before it or followed it. But the band, and it's Mercury Rev I'm talking about, achieved it with the song... which is The Dark Is Rising, which comes from an album called All Is Dream, issued in 2001. And in 2001, I was still buying CDs, but I very rarely bought CD singles. Apart from anything else, they were terribly bad value. They were about £4, and you got, at the tops, three tracks. But I heard this once, realized the only way I was going to get it on any kind of format was to go and buy the CD single, and went out within half an hour of hearing it on the radio and bought the CD single. And I still think it's absolutely extraordinary. You'd struggle to call it a rock song because it's really very orchestral based. There's an enormous multi-tracked orchestra on there. It's melodramatic, to say the least, and I always like melodramatic music. And it could really comfortably sit in some kind of modern opera stage musical. It doesn't follow the sort of the set pattern of a piece of pop music. It has these huge orchestral stabs which die away to reveal the voice of this guy's called Jonathan Donahue, and he has a very sort of reedy or almost sort of female voice that he sings in, and that juxtaposition between that and these huge orchestral stabs is quite arresting. The lyrics are very whimsical and sort of talk a lot about astrology and dreaming and that sort of whimsy, which can be quite annoying, but in this case it does sort of conjure up an ethereal atmosphere to go with all this sort of operatic noise around it. And you get to the end, and I guess for a lot of people they would find it utterly bewildering. I got to the end and was totally enchanted. And back in 2001, for a good 2 or 3 months, there was nothing else I really wanted to listen to except The Dark Is Rising by Mercury Rev, which is my pick for the pretend iPod this week.
And with Mercury Rev, they were one of these groups, again, up to my shame, I had heard of, but actually never heard their canon of work. And so when I saw that this was on your pick, I went to YouTube, in fact, and watched the video for this track. And you're right, I mean, it's absolutely sensational. It's gorgeous. And the video that goes with it, absolutely excellent. Marvellous voice has gotten, as you've said it all, really, the arrangement, everything. Absolutely, absolutely beautiful track. So I was delighted to be introduced to your Mercury Rev.
Yeah.
Well, I am concluding my trinity of Punk Britannia iPod pitches.
Yep.
Because I started off with The Clash, White Man, Hammersmith Palais. Then last week we went to The Members and Sound of the Suburbs. This week I'm taking us to an exact date. I know because I looked up my diary. The 15th of September 1979. I still have the diary. It was a Saturday. And a few weeks ago I wrote about in the column about my girlfriend at the time, who's quite, she was stuck with me for quite a while, longer than most. I said about 10 or 12 years.
She must have been fond of pomposity then.
She was the one whose final words to me were, the last words she ever said to me were, "And you're so pompous."
Oh, so the straw broke eventually then. Yeah.
As she drove away, winding the window up after letting me know that last bit of information.
Oh.
Anyway, this was the fainting girl. I talked about her always fainting when we went to gigs, especially in relation to the Nashville.
Yes, yes.
And probably at her age. I mean, we were only sort of 19, I suppose 20. She was probably about 17 or 18. May have been her age. Maybe she grew out of it. I hope so. But anyway, this fainting girlfriend, Deborah, we went for a week's holiday in this upmarket hotel in Poole in Dorset, and we arrived on the 15th of September 1979, and we had popped out and we'd had afternoon tea as my diary records, at the Spetisbury Tea Rooms, which is Spetisbury is a little village in Dorset.
Mm-hmm.
So we came back to the hotel to repose, is that the word, you know, to get ready for, you know, just chill out and then go out for the evening. And really unusually, for a hotel in 1979, we had a television in the room.
Yeah.
Now, you know, today, obviously, this is standard. We go back down to reception and say, "I say, I haven't got a television in that room." But in 1979, if you've got a tea or coffee making facilities, don't make me laugh.
No.
You wouldn't get that.
No.
But, you know, we had a television. Remarkable. Anyway, there'd been a buzz in the music press about the appearance, I think it was their first on national TV, of these fresh-faced lads from Manchester in clean clothing, no relation to punk. It was Joy Division.
Ah.
It was their first appearance on national TV. So on this small black-and-white television in a hotel room in Dorset, we were watching this program called Something Else.
Yes.
BBC Two. Do you remember?
Well, I do, and this is really odd. Sorry to interrupt your pick, but this is really odd because I recall exactly where I was when I watched that being transmitted as well.
It shows, doesn't it, the impact that it had. But tell us, where were you?
We're
being released from prison.
Yeah, and I was in one of those for 1979 rare prisons where they had a TV in the room.
No to your coffee making facilities.
No.
Widescreen TV.
We were having a new carpet laid in my mum's cottage. I'm considerably younger than you, so I was still living with my parents at this point. And so I remember sitting on the stone floor that was under the old carpet perhaps a Friday evening. I could even stretch my memory to that. I'm thinking it might. Or you said you were on a weekend away, so it may have.
I've checked the date. Yeah. I've looked in my diary. It's a Saturday.
Okay, right. Well, not far off. Yeah. And sitting there on this very uncomfortable stone floor because your carpet layers weren't coming back till the next week. And I saw there was a music program on and it was Something Else, and watched that because they did Transmission, and then later in the show they did She's Lost Control. And I remember it distinctly. Yeah.
And you've picked one of one of those is my very pick this week, because there has been a bit of a buzz about Joy Division, but they weren't well known sort of nationally, and they hadn't been on national TV as far as I know. So this was September 79 onto this program called Something Else, which was a kind of low level TV show. Again, we've got in context, we only had three TV channels. It's ridiculous. Well before, long before MTV was even dreamed of, which is BBC One, BBC to ITV, and we've actually had no music at all. You had the old Grey Whistle Test with Dear Old Whispering Bob, and Top of the Pops with, you know, DLT, Tony Blackburn coming on to promote themselves, really, rather than
yes.
the music. So to get something like this, Something Else, where you would get the if you like, the alternative groups on, was just sensational. Mm. So there'd been this buzz in the NME, I think, during the week before, saying, you know, you've got to watch this. So we turned it on, and we're in this posh hotel in Dorset, and then suddenly on the screen, in this black... I can remember it's a really small screen. You know, it's probably sort of 8 inches. But these fresh-faced lads, as I said earlier, clean clothing, no relation to punk rock really whatsoever in the way they looked in the sun. Bernard Sumner was already knocking out great guitar runs. Hookie had his low-slung bass, and Stephen Morris knew his way around the drum kit. But it was this dead-eyed, zombie, arm-whirling, thin young bloke on vocals who left this big impression. Ian Curtis was the singer with Joy Division, and such a troubled existence was he leading that it was to the extent he ended his life by his own hand on the 18th of May 1980. He was only 23. And this was such an... you can see it on YouTube. Just go YouTube, transmission, something else, whatever, you'll find it. I'm picking the track Transmission because it just shows you this, the intensity of Ian Curtis. His eyes are somewhere else. His mind seems to be somewhere else. He did suffer from epilepsy. We didn't know that at the time. He suffered from depression. We didn't know that at the time. And quite extensive ill health. And immediately after this, as they became famous and more well-known, his epilepsy and his seizures became even worse, and even having them during performances. And there's a lot of speculation, you know, was it the illness, and was it the being overwhelmed by the success, the very quick success? The contrast between the sort of bucolic surroundings of this Dorset hotel and then this sort of industrial manic performance. Yeah. And in a way, without being too Sue's Corner about it, in a sense, it's almost a metaphor for the distance between the Sex Pistols and this sort of new wave of music that was coming at the time. Yeah. And it's just that performance magnet. It's not so much then, you know, as I say, my great affection for Ian Curtis, Joy Division or New Order. It was just that moment of understanding, that just that moment in time has never left me.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. Like, as I say, it must have been, because I remember it being, if you pardon the pun, transmitted at exactly the same time you were watching it in Dorset, and I was watching it in Derbyshire, I don't recall the first time I saw the Pistols or the Clash on the television, but I do recall that performance. It was that striking. And Curtis talked a lot about catharsis, and he had, as you've rightly pointed out, a lot of bad things going on in his life and in his head, and his performances, he always talked about as being his one shot at catharsis, the one moment he could push everything out of his body and his mind, was on stage, and he would do these extraordinary, you could call them dances, but they're not a dance as we would really recognise them.
No.
And they were very much like the sort of shamanistic movements that you see in Nepal or Tibet when you see footage from there. He was doing this thing that Kevin Rowland of Dexys talked about, punishing the body to free the soul, and or to purify the soul. And a similar thing was going on with Curtis, I think, is that he was doing very uncomfortable and almost painful movements. And I think it was in an attempt to reach some kind of clarity, you know. And this all sounds horribly pretentious until you see him do it. And he's clearly doing something along those lines. He did die too young. But the music he made with the other band members that you refer to whilst he was alive is extraordinary. Now, I heard on Six Music the other afternoon, Decades, from the album Closer, Transmissions from the previous album. And I just listened to it and I thought, whatever else I hear this afternoon, it won't be coming from the same place as this song Decades is coming from. But you could have picked any track from Closer or Unknown Pleasures and have the same reaction. They were just from another place. Or Ian Curtis was certainly coming from a different sort of zone of humanity from all the other bands at the time or since. He had his own territory, and he was remarkable for it. So it's a good choice, yeah.
There's a symmetry to what we were talking about last week as well, because as Joy Division's star rose, off they went to record their work at Strawberry Studios, yes, the 10cc studios, yes, in Stockport. Yeah. And we were talking about, again, that distance travelled from last week. We were saying that, you know, the punk bands were going into, I mean, I recall you saying last week about bands going into this kind of tiny little
jingle studios.
But 2 years on, you know, the circle had been broken, and they were going back into the sort of prog rock or poppy studios. You know, in this example, Strawberry Studios of 10cc in Stockport. But I've just got a sad coda to this story of Ian Curtis, which I just thought I'd just do a little bit of research and find out. Deborah, as I say, childhood sort of sweethearts, if you can say that. She was 18, he was 19 when they got married. And back in 2005, Laura Barton of The Guardian interviewed Deborah Curtis. And she asked Deborah Curtis why she thought Ian Curtis didn't just leave instead of hang himself. Mm-hmm. And Deborah said, I don't know. Maybe he was concerned about doing the right thing. Maybe he was torn between what he should do and what he wanted to do. Maybe Annick, the Belgian girl that he was involved with, maybe Annick wasn't the one, but he felt he needed to go. I don't know. I spent a lot of time wondering, because there were so many other things he could have done besides commit suicide. Mm. And that last line just resonates to me, because you think, you know, oh, you know, he was only 23. Absolutely. And of course he was clearly overwhelmed. Yeah. And, you know, one can only speculate the state of mind he was in to do it. But she says there were so many other things he could have done, yeah, besides commit suicide.
And that's an interesting thing for us to say. Somebody I know who's a psychotherapist, who I once fell into conversation with about the nature of suicide, and they said for them the saddest thing about suicide was it's the one option in life that precludes any further options. And I thought, that's it, really. Mm. That's what's so tragic about suicide, is that you know, no matter how many desperate choices you can make in a desperate situation, it's the one that precludes you taking any other options from then on. So, and that's sort of reflected in what Deborah Curtis was saying in your quote there, really. And I would point listeners in the direction of a film called Control, which is about the events that you've just described, really, which is a fantastic movie made by Anton Corbijn, which is about the rise and the untimely death of Ian Curtis. And it's not one of these rather pathetic attempts to, you know, one thinks of Oliver Stone's movie of the Doors. It's probably as far removed from that as it's possible to be, because it's really a story about people who just happen to be in a band. And it's a fantastic film. I'd really recommend that.
I've never seen that, and you've reminded me, I must seek that out, because I've seen 24 Hour Party People, which had a kind of link to Joy Division. It was all about the Tony Wilson era, yeah, of Factory Records, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But I've never seen Control, and I know that it was actually based on Deborah Curtis's biography, yes, of Ian Curtis. So I must have...
Indeed, and it is the very, very different from 24 Hour Party People. Both fine movies, yeah, but there's not much to chuckle about in Control, whereas there is in the other film. But it does justice to Joy Division, because it leaves you with that sort of aching, questioning melancholy that the Joy Division music does. The movie does the same thing, so I can't recommend that highly enough either. Sadly, Barney and Hooky don't talk to each other anymore.
It does
seem ridiculous, after all the things they've been through, all the success they've had, and all the years together in Joy Division New Order, that they can't find any way around this rather silly squabble. But maybe they will one day.
Yes, I hope so. Again, I always think that when this happens, as it happened with Strummer and Mick Jones, as it happened with Lennon and McCartney, you know, I do suspect that years on and years on, they do regret these lost years, if only out of the friendship. Okay, if you don't want to record together anymore, so be it. Mm. But I think it's such wasted years, yeah, when people do this, not speaking, yeah, and, you know, not having anything to do with each other. Times,
yeah,
wasted.
Yeah, I hope they can get past it. But it's a good pick, and any Joy Division pick would have been a good pick, I think. So, yeah, those are two tracks then for the Pretend iPod. We have Mercury Rev and The Dark is Rising, and we have Joy Division and Transmission, bringing us to a close on the podcast this week. Thanks very much for your company. Thanks very much to you, Terence D, all the way there, okay, down in the home counties doing your thing. And we look forward
watching the football.
Well, yeah, good luck with that. And we look forward to your company piping up from the deep south once again in 7 days' time. But most importantly, as I say, thanks to you for listening at home. That has been the Parish Council, and we will see you in a week. Bye-bye.
But it can seem surprising when you find yourself alone. Now the dark is rising,
Dacom Shore Media Production.